Are you suggesting that Jelks... No, said Kalowski sarcastically before Emma could finish her sentence. I always thought it was a coincidence that the DA was coming up for re-election that year, and some of Jelks' clients were among his biggest campaign contributors. Anyway, he continued after exhaling a long cloud of smoke, Bradshaw ended up getting 6 years for desertion when the precinct sweepstakes had him down for 18 months, 2 years tops.
What are you suggesting? Asked Emma.
That the judge accepted Bradshaw was guilty.
Kalowski paused and blew out another cloud of smoke before adding, of murder.
I agree with you and the judge, said Emma. Tom Bradshaw probably was guilty of murder.
Kalowski looked surprised.
But did the man you arrested ever tell you that you'd made a mistake and that he wasn't Tom Bradshaw, but Harry Clifton?
The detective gave Emma a closer look and thought for a moment.
He did say something like that early on, but Jelks must have told him that it wouldn't fly because he never mentioned it again.
Would you be interested, Mr. Kalowski, if I was able to prove that it would fly?
No, ma'am, said Kalowski firmly. That case was closed a long time ago. Your fiancé is doing 6 years for a crime he pleaded guilty to. And I've got too much work on my desk,
he placed a hand on a stack of files,
to be reopening old wounds. Now, unless you've got anything else I can help you with.
Will they allow me to visit Tom at Lavenham?
I can't see why not, said Kalowski. Write to the warden. He'll send you a visiting order. After you've filled it in and sent it back, they'll give you a date. It shouldn't take more than 6 to 8 weeks.
But I haven't got 6 weeks, protested Emma. I need to return to England in a couple of weeks' time. Isn't there anything I can do to speed up the process?
That's only possible on compassionate grounds, said the detective, and that's limited to wives and parents.
What about the mother of the prisoner's child? Countered Emma.
In New York, ma'am, that gives you the same rights as a wife, as long as you can prove it.
Emma produced two photos from her handbag, one of Sebastian and one of Harry standing on the deck of the Kansas Star.
That's good enough for me, said Kalowski, handing back the picture of Harry without commenting. If you promise to leave me in peace, I'll speak to the warden and see if anything can be done.
Thank you, said Emma.
How do I reach you?
I'm staying at the Mayflower Hotel.
I'll be in touch, said Kalowski, making a note. But I don't want you to be in any doubt, ma'am, that Tom Bradshaw killed his brother. I'm sure of it.
And I don't want you to be in any doubt, officer, that the man locked up in Lavenham is not Tom Bradshaw. I'm sure of that.
Emma placed the photographs back in her bag and rose to leave. A frown appeared on the detective's face as she walked out of the room. Emma returned to her hotel, undressed and went straight back to bed. She lay awake, wondering if Kalowski might be having second thoughts about whether he'd arrested the right man. She still couldn't work out why Jelks had allowed Harry to be sentenced to 6 years when it would have been so easy for him to prove that Harry wasn't Tom Bradshaw. She finally fell asleep, grateful not to be woken by any nocturnal visitors. The phone rang when she was in the bathroom, but by the time she'd picked it up, there was only a dial tone. The second call came just as she was closing the door of her room on her way down to breakfast. She dashed back inside and grabbed the phone to hear a voice she recognized on the other end of the line.
Good morning, Officer Kalowski, she replied.
The news isn't good, said the detective, who didn't deal in small talk.
She collapsed onto the bed, fearing the worst.
I spoke to the warden of Lavenham just before I came off duty, and he told me that Bradshaw has made it clear he doesn't want any visitors, no exceptions. It seems that Mr. Jelks has issued an order that he's not even to be informed when someone asks to see him.
Couldn't you try to get a message to him somehow? Begged Emma. I'm sure that if he knew it was me...
Not a hope, lady, said Kalowski. You have no idea how far Jelks's tentacles reach.
He can overrule a prison warden.
A prison warden is small fry. The DA and half the judges in New York are under his thumb. Just don't tell anyone I said so.
The line went dead. Emma didn't know how much time had passed before she heard a knock on the door. Who could it possibly be? The door opened and a friendly face peered in.
Can I clean the room, miss?
Asked a woman, pushing a trolley.
I'll only be a couple of minutes, said Emma.
She checked her watch and was surprised to find it was 10 past 10. She needed to clear her head before she could consider her next move and decided to take a long walk in Central Park. She strolled around the park before making a decision. The time had come to visit her great aunt and seek her advice about what she should do next. Emma headed off in the direction of 64th and Park and was so deep in thought about how she was going to explain to Great Aunt Phyllis why she hadn't visited her earlier that what she saw didn't fully register. She stopped, turned and retraced her steps, checking every window until she reached Doubleday's. A pyramid of books dominated the center window, alongside a photograph of a man with slicked back, black hair and a pencil moustache. He was smiling out at her. The Diary of a Convict. My Time at Lavenham Maximum Security Prison by Max Lloyd. The author of the runaway bestseller will be signing books in this store at 5 p.m. on Thursday. Don't miss this opportunity to meet the author.
Giles Barrington, 1941. Chapter 16. Giles had no idea where the regiment was going. For days he seemed to be perpetually on the move, never able to sleep for more than a couple of hours at a time. First he boarded a train, followed by a truck, before he climbed up the gangway of a troop carrier that ploughed through the ocean waves at its own pace, until it finally disgorged 1,000 soldiers from the Wessex at the Egyptian port of Alexandria on the North African coast. During the voyage, Giles had been reunited with his chums from Ypres Camp on Dartmoor, who he had to accept were now under his command. One or two of them, Bates in particular, didn't find it easy to call him Sir, and found it even more difficult to salute him every time they bumped into each other. A convoy of army vehicles awaited the Wessex Regiment as they disembarked from the ship. Giles had never experienced such intense heat, and his fresh khaki shirt was soaked in sweat within moments of him stepping on foreign soil. He quickly organized his men into three groups before they climbed on board the waiting trucks. The convoy progressed slowly along a narrow, dusty coastal road, not stopping for several hours until they finally reached the outskirts of a badly bombed town that Bates announced in a loud voice, "Tobruk! Told you so!" And money began to change hands. Once they'd entered the town, the convoy dropped the men at various points. Giles and the other officers jumped off outside the Majestic Hotel, which had been requisitioned by the Wessex as their company HQ. Giles pushed his way through the revolving doors and quickly discovered there wasn't much Majestic about the hotel. Makeshift offices had been crammed into every available space. Charts and maps were pinned on walls where paintings had once hung, and the plush red carpet that welcomed VIPs from all over the world had worn thin with the continual tramping of studded boots. The reception area was the only feature to remind them this might once have been a hotel. A duty corporal checked off Second Lieutenant Barrington's name on a long list of new arrivals. "Room 219, he said, handing him an envelope. "You'll find everything you need in there, sir." Giles strode up the wide staircase to the second floor and let himself into the room. He sat on the bed, opened the envelope, and read his orders. At 7 o'clock he was to report to the ballroom, when the colonel of the regiment would address all officers. Giles unpacked his suitcase, took a shower, put on a clean shirt, and went back downstairs. He grabbed a sandwich and a cup of tea from the officers' mess, and made his way to the ballroom just before 7. The large room, with its high imperial ceiling and magnificent chandeliers, was already filled with boisterous officers, who were being reunited with old friends and introduced to new ones as they waited to find out which square on the chessboard they would be moved to. Giles caught a glimpse of a young lieutenant on the far side of the room whom he thought he recognised, but then lost sight of him. At 1 minute to seven, Lieutenant Colonel Robertson marched up onto the stage, and everyone else in the room quickly fell silent and sprang to attention. He stopped in the centre of the stage and waved the men down. Feet apart, hands on hips, he began to address them.
"Gentlemen, it must seem strange to you to have travelled from all parts of the Empire to do battle with the Germans in North Africa. However, Field Marshal Rommel and his Africa Corps are also here, with the purpose of maintaining a supply of oil for their troops in Europe. It is our responsibility to send him back to Berlin with a bloody nose, long before their last tank has run out of petrol."
Cheers erupted around the hall, accompanied by the stamping of feet.
"General Wavell has granted the Wessex the privilege of defending Tobruk, and I have told him that we will all sacrifice our lives before Rommel books a suite at the Majestic Hotel."
This was greeted with even louder cheers and more stamping of feet.
"Now, I want you all to report to your company commanders, who will brief you on our overall plan to defend the town, and the responsibilities each of you will be expected to carry out. Gentlemen, we haven't a moment to waste. Good luck, and happy hunting."
The officers all sprang to attention again as the colonel left the stage. Giles checked his orders once more. He'd been allocated to 7 Platoon, C Company, which was to meet in the hotel library following the colonel's address for a briefing by Major Richards.
"You must be Barrington," said the major, when Giles walked into the library a few minutes later.
Giles saluted.
"It was good of you to join us so soon after being commissioned. I put you in charge of 7 Platoon as understudy to your old friend. You will have 3 sections of 12 men, and your responsibility will be to patrol the west perimeter of the city. You will have a sergeant and 3 corporals to assist you. The lieutenant will brief you on the finer details. As you were at school together, you won't have to spend too much time getting to know each other."
Giles wondered who it could be, and then he recalled the familiar lone figure on the other side of the ballroom. Second Lieutenant Giles Barrington would have liked to give Lieutenant Fisher the benefit of the doubt, although he would never be able to erase the memory of him as a prefect at St. Bede's, when he thrashed Harry every night during his first week, for no reason other than that he was a docker's son.
"It's good to catch up with you, Barrington, after such a long time," said Fisher. "I can't see any reason why we shouldn't work well together, can you?"
He obviously also recalled his treatment of Harry Clifton. Giles managed a weak smile.
"We've got over 30 men under our command, along with 3 corporals and a sergeant. Some of them you'll remember from your days at training camp. In fact, I've already put Corporal Bates in charge of No. 1 section."
"Terry Bates?"
"Corporal Bates," repeated Fisher. "Never use a Christian name when you're referring to the other ranks. In the mess, and when we're on our own, Giles, you can call me Alex, but never in front of the men. Sure you understand?"
"You always were an arrogant little shit, and clearly nothing has changed," thought Giles. This time he didn't smile.
"Now it's our responsibility to patrol the western perimeter of the town in 4-hour watches. Don't underestimate the importance of our task, because if Rommel does attack Tobruk, intelligence is that he'll try and enter the city from the west. So we have to remain vigilant at all times. I'll leave it to you to fix the rotors. I usually manage a couple of shifts a day, but I can't do a lot more because of my other responsibilities."
"Like what?" Giles wanted to ask him. Giles enjoyed patrolling the west side of the town with his men, and quickly got to know all 36 of them, not least because Corporal Bates kept him so well informed. And although he tried to keep them on perpetual alert following Fisher's warning, as the weeks passed without incident, he began to wonder if they'd ever come face to face with the enemy. It was on a hazy evening in early April, when all 3 of Giles's patrols were out on an exercise, that a volley of bullets came from nowhere. The men instantly hit the ground and quickly crawled to the nearest building to find whatever cover they could. Giles had been with the leading section when the Germans presented their calling card, then fired off a second volley. The bullets fell nowhere near their target, but he knew it wouldn't be long before the enemy identified his position.
Don't fire until I say so,
he ordered, as he slowly scanned the horizon with his binoculars. He decided to brief Fisher before he made a move. He picked up the field phone and got an immediate response.
How many of them are there, do you think?
Fisher asked.
I guess no more than 70, at most 80. If you bring forward number 2 and 3 sections, that should be more than enough to hold them off until reinforcements arrive.
A third volley followed, but after Giles had scanned the horizon, he once again gave the order.
Hold your fire. I'll send up 2 section under Sergeant Harris to support you, said Fisher, and if you keep me briefed, I'll decide whether to join you with 3 section.
The phone went dead. A fourth volley quickly followed the third, and this time when Giles focused his binoculars, he could see a dozen men crawling across the open ground towards them.
Take aim, but don't fire until the target is in range, and make sure every bullet counts.
Bates was the first to squeeze his trigger.
Got you,
he said, as a German collapsed into the desert sand. As he reloaded, he added,
That'll teach you to bomb Broad Street. Shut up, Bates, and concentrate, said Giles. Sorry, sir.
Giles continued to scan the horizon. He could see 2, possibly 3 men who'd been hit and were lying face down in the sand a few yards from their dugouts. He gave the order to fire another volley, and Giles watched as several more Germans scampered back to safety like ants scurrying down a hole.
Cease fire!
Shouted Giles, aware that they couldn't afford to waste precious ammunition. He looked to his left and could see 2 section already in position under Sergeant Harris, awaiting their orders. He picked up the field phone and Fisher came back on the line.
My ammunition won't last much longer, sir. My left flank's now covered by Sergeant Harris, but my right flank's exposed. If you were able to come forward, we'd have a better chance of holding them off.
Now that you've got 2 section to strengthen your position, Barrington, I'd better stay back and cover you in case they break through.
Another volley of bullets flew in their direction. The Germans had clearly worked out exactly where they were positioned, but Giles still instructed his 2 sections to hold fire. He cursed, put down the phone and ran across the open gap to join Sergeant Harris. A volley followed his trouble.
What do you think, Sergeant?
It's a half company, sir, about 80 men in all. But I think they're just a reconnaissance party, so all we have to do is bed down and be patient.
I agree, said Giles.
What do you think they'll do? Well, the Krauts will know that they outnumber us, so they'll want to mount an attack before any reinforcements arrive. If Lieutenant Fisher brought up 3 section to cover our right flank, it would strengthen our position.
I agree, repeated Giles, as another volley greeted them. I'll go back and speak to Fisher. Await my orders.
Giles zigzagged across the open terrain. This time the bullets were a little too close to risk that trick again. He was just about to call Fisher when the field phone rang. He grabbed it.
Barrington, said Fisher. I believe the time has come for us to take the initiative.
Giles needed to repeat Fisher's words to be sure he'd heard them correctly.
You want me to lead an attack on the Germans' position, while you bring forward 3 section to cover me?
If we do that, said Bates, we'd be like sitting ducks on a rifle range.
Shut up, Bates.
Yes, sir.
Sergeant Harris thinks, and I agree with him, continued Giles, that if you bring up 3 section to cover our right flank, the Germans would have to mount an attack, and then we could...
I'm not interested in what Sergeant Harris thinks, said Fisher. I give the orders, and you'll carry them out. Is that clear?
Yes, sir,
Giles said, as he slammed down the phone.
I could always kill him, sir, said Bates.
Giles ignored him as he loaded his pistol and attached 6 hand grenades to his webbed belt. He stood up so that both platoons could see him, and said in a loud voice,
Fix bayonets, and prepare to advance.
He then stepped out from behind his cover and shouted,
Follow me!
As Giles began to run across the deep, scorching sand with Sergeant Harris and Corporal Bates only a stride behind him, he was greeted with yet another volley of bullets and wondered how long he would survive against such overwhelming odds. With 40 yards still to cover, he could see exactly where the 3 enemy dugouts were situated. He snatched a hand grenade from his belt, removed the pin, and tossed it towards the center dugout, as if he was returning a cricket ball from the deep boundary into the wicketkeeper's gloves. It landed just above the stumps. Giles saw 2 men fly into the air, while another fell back. He swung round and hurled a second grenade to his left, a definite run-out, because the enemy's firepower suddenly dried up. The third grenade took out a machine gun. As Giles charged on, he could see the men who had him in their sights. He took his pistol out of its holster and began to fire as if he was on a shooting range, but this time the bullseyes were human beings. One, two, three went down, and then Giles saw a German officer lining him up in his sights. The German pulled the trigger, just a moment too late, and collapsed on the ground in front of him. Giles felt sick. When he was only a yard from the dugout, a young German dropped his rifle on the ground, while another threw his arms high into the air. Giles stared into the desperate eyes of the defeated men. He didn't need to speak German to know they didn't want to die.
"Cease fire!" screamed Giles,
as what was left of one and two sections quickly overwhelmed the enemy positions.
"Round them up and disarm them, Sergeant Harris," he added,
then turned back to see Harris, head down in the sand, blood trickling out of his mouth, only yards from the dugout. Giles stared back across the open terrain they had crossed and tried not to count the number of soldiers who had sacrificed their lives because of one man's weak decision. Stretcher-bearers were already removing the dead bodies from the battlefield.
"Corporal Bates, line up the enemy prisoners in threes and march them back to camp."
"Yes, sir," said Bates,
sounding as if he meant it. A few minutes later, Giles and his depleted band headed back across the open ground. They had covered about 50 yards when Giles saw Fisher running towards him, with three section following in his wake.
"Right, Barrington, I'll take over," he shouted. "You bring up the rear, follow me,"
he ordered, as he led the captured German soldiers triumphantly back towards the town. By the time they reached the Majestic Hotel, a small crowd had gathered to cheer them. Fisher returned the salutes of his brother officers.
"Barrington, see that the prisoners are interned. Then take the lads off to the canteen for a drink. They've earned it. Meanwhile, I'll report to Major Richards."
"Can I kill him, sir?" asked Bates.
Chapter 17. When Giles came down for breakfast the following morning, several officers, some of whom he'd never spoken to before, went out of their way to shake hands with him. As he strolled into the mess, several heads turned and smiled in his direction, which he found slightly embarrassing. He grabbed a bowl of porridge, two boiled eggs, and an out-of-date copy of Punch. He sat alone, hoping to be left in peace, but a few moments later, three Australian officers he didn't recognize joined him. He turned a page of Punch and laughed at an E.H. Shepherd cartoon of Hitler retreating from Calais on a penny farthing.
"An incredible act of courage," said the Australian on his right.
Giles could feel himself turning red.
"I agree," said a voice from the other side of the table. "Quite remarkable."
Giles wanted to leave before they...
"What did you say the fella's name was?"
Giles took a spoonful of porridge.
"Fisher."
Giles nearly choked.
"It seems that Fisher, against all odds, led his platoon over open terrain, and with only hand grenades and a pistol, took out three dugouts full of German soldiers."
"Unbelievable," said another voice.
At least Giles could agree with that.
"And is it true that he killed a Hun officer and then took 50 of the bastards prisoner, with only 12 men to back him up?"
Giles removed the top of his first boiled egg. It was hard.
"It must be true," said another voice, "because he's been promoted to captain."
Giles sat and stared at the yolk of his egg.
"I'm told he'll be recommended for a military cross." "Well, that's the least he deserves."
The least he deserved, thought Giles, was what Bates had recommended.
"Anyone else involved in the action?"
asked the voice from the other side of the table.
"Yes, he's second in command, but I'm damned if I can remember his name."
Giles had heard enough and decided to let Fisher know exactly what he thought of him. Leaving his second egg untouched, he marched out of the mess and headed straight for the ops room. He was so angry that he barged in without knocking. The moment he entered the room, he sprang to attention and saluted.
"I do apologize, sir," he said. "I had no idea you were here."
"This is Mr. Barrington, Colonel," said Fisher. "You remember that I told you he assisted me in yesterday's action?"
Ah, yes, Barrington, good show. You may not have seen company orders this morning, but you've been promoted to full lieutenant, and having read Captain Fisher's report, I can tell you that you'll also be mentioned in dispatches.
Many congratulations, Giles, said Fisher. Well deserved.
Indeed, said the colonel. And while you're here, Barrington, I was just saying to Captain Fisher, now that he's identified Rommel's preferred route into Tobruk, we'll need to double our patrols on the west side of the city and deploy a full squadron of tanks to back you up.
He jabbed the map, spread out on the table, with his finger.
Here, here, and here. I hope you both agree.
I do, sir, said Fisher. I'll set about getting the platoon in place immediately.
Can't be too soon, said the colonel, because I have a feeling it won't be long before Rommel returns, and this time he won't be on a reconnaissance mission but leading the full force of the Africa Corps. We must be lying in wait and be sure that he walks straight into our trap.
We'll be ready for him, sir, said Fisher.
Good, because I'm putting you in charge of our new patrols, Fisher. Barrington, you will remain second in command.
I'll have my report on your desk by midday, sir, said Fisher.
Good show, Fisher. I'll leave you to work out the details.
Thank you, sir,
said Fisher, standing to attention and saluting as the colonel left the room. Giles was about to speak, but Fisher quickly jumped in.
I've put in a recommendation that Sergeant Harris should be awarded a posthumous military medal, and Corporal Bates should also be mentioned in dispatches. I hope you'll support me.
Am I also to understand that you've been put up for a military cross? Asked Giles.
That's not in my hands, old fellow, but I'm happy to go along with whatever the commanding officer sees fit. Now, let's get down to business. With six patrols now under our command, I propose that we...
After what had become known by one and two sections as Fisher's fantasy, everyone from the colonel downwards was on red alert. Two platoons patrolled the western edge of the town, one on, one off, night and day, no longer wondering if, only when, Rommel would appear over the horizon at the head of his Africa Corps. Even Fisher, in his newly elevated state as hero, had to appear occasionally on the outer perimeter, if simply to maintain the myth of his heroic deed, but only long enough to be sure everyone had seen him. He would then report back to the tank squadron commander, 3 miles to the rear, and set up his field phones. The Desert Fox chose April the 11th, 1941, to begin his assault on Tobruk. The British and Australians couldn't have fought more bravely when defending the perimeter against the German onslaught. But as the months passed and supplies of food and ammunition began to run low, few doubted, though it was never voiced, that it could only be a matter of time before the sheer size of Rommel's army would overwhelm them. It was a Friday morning, just as the desert haze was clearing, that Lieutenant Barrington scanned the horizon with his binoculars and focused on rows and rows of German tanks.
Shit,
he said. He grabbed the field phone as a shell hit the building he and his men had selected as their observation post. Fisher came on the other end of the line.
I can see 40, possibly 50 tanks heading towards us, Giles told him, and what looks like a full regiment of soldiers to back them up. Permission to withdraw my men to a more secure position where we can regroup and take up battle formation.
Hold your ground, said Fisher. And once the enemy's within range, engage them.
Engage them, said Giles. What with, bows and arrows? This isn't Agincourt, Fisher. I've got barely 100 men facing a regiment of tanks, with nothing more than rifles to protect ourselves. For God's sake, Fisher, allow me to decide what's best for my men.
Hold your ground, repeated Fisher, and engage the enemy when they come within range. That's an order.
Giles slammed the phone down.
Some reason best known to himself, said Bates. That man doesn't want you to survive. You should have let me shoot him.
Another shell hit the building while masonry and rubble began to fall around them. Giles no longer needed binoculars to see just how many tanks were advancing towards them, and to accept that he only had moments to live.
Take aim.
He suddenly thought of Sebastian, who would inherit the family title. If the boy turned out to be half as good as Harry had been, the Barrington dynasty need have no fear for its future. The next shell hit the building behind them, and Giles could clearly see a German soldier returning his stare from the turret of his tank.
Fire!
As the building began to collapse around him, Giles thought about Emma, Grace, his father, his mother, his grandfathers, and... The next shell brought the entire edifice crashing down. Giles looked up to see a large piece of masonry falling, falling, falling. He leapt on top of Bates, who was still firing at an advancing tank. The last image Giles saw was Harry swimming to safety.
Emma Barrington, 1941. Chapter 18. Emma sat alone in her hotel room, reading The Diary of a Convict from cover to cover. She didn't know who Max Lloyd was, but she was sure of one thing. He wasn't the author. Only one man could have written this book. She recognized so many familiar phrases, and Lloyd hadn't even bothered to change all the names, unless, of course, he had a girlfriend called Emma, whom he still adored. Emma turned the last page just before midnight and decided to make a phone call to someone who would still be at work. "Just one more favor," she begged when his voice came on the line.
"Try me,"
he said. "I need the name of Max Lloyd's parole officer."
"Max Lloyd, the author?"
"No less."
"I'm not even going to ask why."
She began to read the book a second time, making pencil notes in the margin. But long before the new deputy librarian had started, she had fallen asleep. She woke around 5 the next morning and didn't stop reading until a prison officer entered the library and said,
"Lloyd, the warden wants to see you."
Emma took a long, lazy bath and considered the fact that all the information she'd been trying so hard to discover had been available for $1.50 from any bookstore. Once she was dressed, she went down to breakfast and picked up a copy of the New York Times. She was taken by surprise as she turned the pages to come across a review of The Diary of a Convict.
"We should be grateful to Mr. Lloyd for bringing to our attention what is happening in our prisons today. Lloyd is a gifted writer with real talent, and we must hope that now he's been released, he will not put down his pen."
"He never picked it up in the first place," thought Emma indignantly as she signed her bill. Before going back up to her room, she asked the receptionist to recommend a good restaurant near Doubleday's bookstore.
"The Brasserie, madam? It has a first-class reputation. Would you like me to book a table for you?"
"Yes, please," said Emma. "I'd like a table for one at lunch today and another for 2 this evening." The receptionist was quickly learning not to be surprised by the lady from England. Emma returned to her room and settled down to read the diary once more. She was puzzled why the narrative opened with Harry's arrival at Lavenham, despite the fact that there were several references scattered throughout the book which suggested that his previous experiences had also been recorded, even if they hadn't been seen by the publisher and certainly not the public. In fact, this convinced Emma that there had to be another notebook in existence, which would not only describe Harry's arrest and trial, but might explain why he had put himself through such an ordeal, when a lawyer of Mr. Jelks's standing must have known that he was not Tom Bradshaw. After reading marked pages of the diaries for a third time, Emma decided another long stroll in the park was required. As she walked up Lexington Avenue, she dropped into Bloomingdale's and placed an order that she was assured would be ready for collection by 3 o'clock. In Bristol, the same order would have taken a fortnight. As she walked through the park, a plan was beginning to form in her mind, but she needed to return to Doubleday's and take a closer look at the store's layout before she could apply the finishing touches. When she walked into the bookstore, the staff were already preparing for the author signing. A table was in place, and a roped-off area showed clearly where the line should form. The poster in the window now had a bold red banner across it, declaring, "Today." Emma selected a gap between 2 rows of shelves, from which she would have a clear view of Lloyd while he was signing, and would be able to observe her prey while setting him a trap. She left Doubleday's just before 1 p.m. and made her way across Fifth Avenue to the Brasserie. a waiter showed her to a table that would never have been considered acceptable by either of her grandfathers. But the meal was, as promised, first class, and when the bill was presented, she took a deep breath and left a large tip. "I've booked a table for this evening," she said to the waiter. "Would it be possible to be seated in an alcove?" The waiter looked doubtful, until Emma produced a dollar bill which seemed to remove any doubt. She was getting the hang of how things worked in America. "What's your name?" Emma asked as she passed him the note.
"Jimmy," the waiter replied.
"And another thing, Jimmy."
"Yes, ma'am."
"May I keep a copy of the menu?"
"Of course, ma'am."
On the way back to the Mayflower, Emma called in at Bloomingdale's and picked up her order. She smiled when the clerk showed her an example of the card.
"I hope it's satisfactory, madam."
"Couldn't be better," said Emma. Once she was back in her room, she went over her prepared questions again and again, and after deciding on the best possible order, she penciled them neatly onto the back of the menu. Exhausted, she lay down on the bed and fell into a deep sleep. When the persistent ringing of the phone woke her, it was already dark outside. She checked her watch. 5:10 p.m.
"Damn," she said as she picked up the phone.
"I know the feeling," said a voice on the other end of the line, "even if that wasn't the four-letter word I would have chosen."
Emma laughed.
"The name you're looking for is Brett Elders." "I didn't tell you."
"Thank you," said Emma. "I'll try not to bother you again."
"I wish," said the detective, and the line went dead.
Emma wrote the name Brett Elders neatly in pencil at the top right-hand corner of the menu. She would like to have taken a quick shower and changed her clothes, but she was already running late and she couldn't afford to miss him. She grabbed the menu and three of the cards. Stuffing them into her bag, she then dashed out of the door and down the staircase, not waiting for the elevator. She hailed a cab and leapt into the back. "Doubleday's on Fifth," she said, "and make it snappy."
"Oh, no,"
Emma thought as the taxi sped away. "What's happening to me?" Emma entered the crowded bookstore and took her chosen spot between politics and religion from where she could observe Max Lloyd at work. He was signing each book with a flourish, basking in the glow of his adoring fans. Emma knew it should have been Harry sitting there receiving the accolades. Did he even know his work had been published? Would she find out tonight? As it turned out, she needn't have rushed, because Lloyd went on signing his runaway bestseller for another hour until the line began to dwindle. He was taking longer and longer with each message, in the hope that it might entice others to join the queue. As he was chatting expansively to the last customer in the line, Emma deserted her post and strolled across.
"And how is your dear mother?"
the customer was asking effusively.
"Very well, thank you," said Lloyd, "no longer having to work in a hotel," he added, "following the success of my book."
The customer smiled.
"And Emma, dare I ask?"
"We're going to be married in the fall," said Lloyd after he'd signed her copy.
"Are we indeed?" thought Emma. "Oh, I'm so glad," said the customer. "She sacrificed so much for you. Do give her my best wishes."
"Why don't you turn around and do it in person?" Emma wanted to say.
"I most certainly will," said Lloyd as he handed her the book and gave her his back cover smile.
Emma stepped forward and handed a card to Lloyd. He studied it for a moment before the same smile reappeared.
"A fellow agent," he said, standing to greet her.
Emma shook his outstretched hand and somehow managed to return his smile.
"Yes," she said, "and several publishers in London are showing considerable interest in the rights to your book. Of course, if you've already signed a contract or are represented by another agent in England, I wouldn't want to waste your time."
"No, no, dear lady. I'm very happy to consider any proposal you might have."
Then perhaps you would join me for dinner so we can talk further.
I think they're expecting me to have dinner with them, whispered Lloyd, waving an expansive hand in the direction of some of the members of the Doubleday staff.
What a pity, said Emma. I'm flying to LA tomorrow to visit Hemingway.
Then I'll have to disappoint them, won't I? Said Lloyd. I'm sure they'll understand.
Good. Shall we meet at the brasserie, then, when you've finished signing?
You'll do well to get a table at such short notice.
I don't think that will be a problem, said Emma, before one last customer stepped forward, still hoping to get a signature. I'll look forward to seeing you later, Mr. Lloyd.
Max, please.
Emma made her way out of the bookstore and walked across Fifth Avenue to the brasserie. This time, she wasn't kept waiting. Jimmy, she said, as the waiter accompanied her to an alcove table. I have a very important client joining me, and I want it to be an evening he won't forget.
You can rely on me, madam, the waiter said as Emma sat down.
After he'd gone, she opened her bag, took out the menu, and went over her list of questions once more. When she saw Jimmy heading towards her with Max Lloyd in his wake, she turned the menu over.
You're obviously well known here, said Lloyd as he slipped into the seat opposite her.
It's my favorite New York restaurant, said Emma, returning his smile.
Can I get you a drink, sir?
Manhattan on the rocks.
And you, madam?
My usual, Jimmy. The waiter hurried off. Emma was curious to discover what he would come back with.
Why don't we order, said Emma, and then we can get down to business.
Good idea, replied Lloyd, although I know exactly what I want, he added as the waiter reappeared and placed a Manhattan in front of him and a glass of white wine by Emma's side.
The drink she'd ordered at lunch. Emma was impressed. Jimmy, I think we're ready to order. The waiter nodded and turned to Emma's guest.
I'll have one of your juicy sirloin steaks. Make it medium and don't spare on the trimmings.
Certainly, sir.
Turning to Emma, he asked, What can I tempt you with this evening, madam? A Caesar salad, please, Jimmy, but light on the dressing. Once the waiter was out of earshot, she turned her menu back over, although she didn't need to be reminded of the first question. The diary only covered 18 months of your incarceration, she said. But you served more than 2 years, so I hope we can look forward to another volume.
I still have a notebook full of material, said Lloyd, relaxing for the first time. I've been thinking about incorporating some of the more extraordinary events I experienced in a novel that I have planned.
Because if you ever wrote them as a diary, any publisher would realize you weren't the author, Emma wanted to say. The sommelier appeared by Lloyd's side, summoned by the demand of an empty glass.
Would you care to see the wine list, sir? Something to complement the steak, perhaps?
Good idea, said Lloyd, opening the thick, leather-bound book as if he were the host.
He ran his finger down a long list of burgundies and paused near the bottom.
A bottle of the 37, I think. An excellent choice, sir.
Emma presumed that meant it wasn't cheap, but this was not an occasion to quibble over price. And what a nasty piece of work Hessler turned out to be, she said, glancing at her second question. I thought that sort of person only existed in trashy novels or B-movies.
No, he was real enough, said Lloyd, but I did get him transferred to another prison, if you remember.
I do, said Emma, as a large steak was placed in front of her guest and a Caesar salad on her side of the table. Lloyd picked up his knife and fork, clearly ready for the challenge.
So tell me, what sort of proposal do you have in mind? He asked as he dug into the steak.
One where you get exactly what you're worth, said Emma, the tone of her voice changing. And not a penny more.
A puzzled look appeared on Lloyd's face, and he put down his knife and fork as he waited for Emma to continue.
I am well aware, Mr. Lloyd, that you didn't write one word of the diary of a convict other than to replace the real author's name with your own. Lloyd opened his mouth, but before he had time to protest, Emma continued. If you're foolish enough to keep up the pretense that you wrote the book, my first visit in the morning will be to Mr. Brett Elders, your parole officer, and it won't be to discuss how well your rehabilitation is going. The sommelier reappeared, uncorked a bottle and waited to be told who would be tasting the wine. Lloyd was staring at Emma like a rabbit caught in the glare of headlights, so she gave a slight nod. She took her time swirling the wine around in her glass before taking a sip. Excellent, she eventually said. I particularly like the 37. The sommelier bowed slightly, poured two glasses, and went off in search of another victim. You can't prove I didn't write it, said Lloyd defiantly. Yes, I can, said Emma, because I represent the man who did. She took a sip of wine before adding, Tom Bradshaw, your deputy librarian. Lloyd sank back into his seat and lapsed into a sullen silence. So let me outline the deal I'm proposing, Mr. Lloyd, while at the same time making it clear that there is no room for negotiation. Unless, of course, you want to go back to prison on a charge of fraud as well as theft. Should you end up in Pierpoint, I have a feeling Mr. Hessler will be only too happy to escort you to your cell, as he doesn't come out of the book very well. Lloyd didn't look as if the idea appealed to him. Emma took another sip of wine before continuing, Mr. Bradshaw has generously agreed to allow you to continue the myth that you wrote the diary, and he won't even expect you to give back the advance you were paid, which, in any case, I suspect you've already spent. Lloyd pursed his lips. However, he wishes to make it clear that should you be foolish enough to attempt to sell the rights in any other country, a writ for copyright theft will be issued against you and the publisher concerned. Is that clear?
Yes, mumbled Lloyd, clutching the arms of his chair.
Good. Then that's settled, said Emma, and after taking another sip of wine, added, I feel sure you'll agree, Mr. Lloyd, that there's no purpose in us continuing this conversation, so perhaps the time has come for you to leave. Lloyd hesitated. We'll meet again at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at 49 Wall Street.
49 Wall Street?
The office of Mr. Sefton Jelks, Tom Bradshaw's lawyer.
So it's Jelks who's behind this. Well, that explains everything.
Emma didn't understand what he meant, but said, You will bring every single notebook with you and hand them over. Should you be even 1 minute late, I will instruct Mr. Jelks to call your probation officer and tell him what you've been up to since you left Lavenham. Stealing a client's earnings is one thing, but claiming you wrote his book... Lloyd continued to grip the arms of his chair, but said nothing. You may go now, Mr. Lloyd, said Emma. I look forward to seeing you in the lobby of 49 Wall Street at 10 tomorrow morning. Don't be late, unless you want your next appointment to be with Mr. Elders. Lloyd rose unsteadily to his feet and made his way slowly across the restaurant, leaving one or two customers wondering if he was drunk. A waiter held the door open for him, then hurried over to Emma's table. Seeing the untouched steak and a full glass of wine, he asked anxiously, I hope everything was all right, Miss Barrington. It couldn't have gone better, Jimmy, she said, pouring herself another glass of wine. Chapter 19. Once Emma had returned to her hotel room, she checked the back of her lunch menu and was delighted to confirm that she'd been able to tick off almost every question. She thought her demand that the notebook should be handed over in the lobby of 49 Wall Street was inspired, because it must have left Lloyd with the distinct impression that Mr. Jelks was her lawyer, which would have put the fear of God into a perfectly innocent man. Although she was still puzzled by what Lloyd had meant when he'd let slip the words, So it's Jelks who's behind this,
Well, that explains everything.
She switched off the light and slept soundly for the first time since she'd left England. Emma's morning routine followed much the same pattern as previous days. After a leisurely breakfast, shared only with the New York Times, she left the hotel and took a cab to Wall Street. She had planned to be a few minutes early, and the cab dropped her off outside the building at 9:51 a.m. As she handed the driver a quarter, she was relieved that her visit to New York was coming to an end. It had turned out to be far more expensive than she had anticipated. Two meals at the Brasserie with a $5 bottle of wine plus tips didn't help. However, she wasn't in any doubt that the trip had been worthwhile, not least because the photographs taken on board the Kansas Star had confirmed her belief that Harry was still alive and had, for some reason, assumed Tom Bradshaw's identity. Once she'd got her hands on the missing notebook, the rest of the mystery would unravel, and surely she would now be able to convince Officer Kalowski that Harry should be released. She didn't intend to return to England without him. Emma joined a stampede of office workers as they made their way into the building. They all headed towards the nearest available elevator, but Emma didn't join them. She placed herself strategically between the reception desk and the bank of 12 lifts, which allowed her an unimpeded view of everyone who entered 49 Wall Street. She checked her watch. 9:54. No sign of Lloyd. She checked it again at 9:57. 9:58, 9:59, and 10 o'clock. Must have been held up by traffic. 10:02, her eyes rested for a split second on every person who came in. 10:04, had she missed him? 10:06, she glanced toward reception. Still no sign of him. 10:08, she tried to stop negative thoughts from entering her mind. 10:11, had he called her bluff? 10:14, would her next appointment have to be with Mr. Brett Elders? 10:17, oh, how much longer was she willing to hang about? 10:21, and a voice behind her said, "Good morning, Miss Barrington." Emma swung round and came face to face with Samuel Anscott, who said politely, "Mr. Jalks wonders if you'd be kind enough to join him in his office." Without another word, Anscott turned and walked towards a waiting elevator. Emma only just managed to jump in before the doors closed. Conversation was out of the question as the packed elevator made its slow, interrupted journey to the 22nd floor, where Anscott stepped out and led Emma down a long, oak-panelled, thickly carpeted corridor, lined with portraits of previous senior partners and their colleagues on the board, giving an impression of honesty, integrity and propriety. Emma would have liked to question Anscott before she met Jalks for the first time, but he remained several paces ahead of her. When he reached a door at the end of the corridor, Anscott knocked and opened it without waiting for a response. He stood aside to allow Emma to enter, then closed the door, but didn't join them. There, sitting in a comfortable, high-backed chair by the window, was Max Lloyd. He was smoking a cigarette and gave Emma the same smile he'd bestowed on her when they had first met at Doubleday's. She turned her attention to a tall, elegantly dressed man who rose slowly from behind his desk. No hint of a smile or any suggestion that they should shake hands. Behind him was a wall of glass, beyond which skyscrapers towered into the sky, suggesting unfettered power. "It's kind of you to join us, Miss Barrington," he said. "Please have a seat." Emma sank into a leather chair so deep that she almost disappeared from sight. She noticed a stack of notebooks on the senior partner's desk. "My name is Sefton Jalks," he began, "and I have the privilege of representing the distinguished and acclaimed author, Mr. Max Lloyd. My client visited me earlier this morning to tell me that he had been approached by someone claiming to be a literary agent from London who was making an accusation, a slanderous accusation, that he was not the author of The Diary of a Convict, which bears his name. It may interest you to know, Miss Barrington,"
continued Jelks, "that I am in possession of the original manuscript, every word of which is written in Mr. Lloyd's hand." He placed a fist firmly on top of the notebooks and allowed himself the suggestion of a smile. "May I be allowed to see one?" asked Emma. "Of course," replied Jelks. He removed the book on top of the pile and handed it to her. Emma opened it and began to read. The first thing she saw was that it wasn't written in Harry's bold hand, but it was Harry's voice. She handed the book back to Mr. Jelks, who replaced it at the top of the pile. "May I have a look at one of the others?" she asked. "No. We've proved our point, Miss Barrington," said Jelks, "and my client will take advantage of every remedy the law provides, should you be foolish enough to repeat your slander." Emma kept her eyes on the pile of notebooks, while Jelks continued in full flow. "I also felt it appropriate to have a word with Mr. Elders to warn him you might be in touch, and to let him know that should he agree to see you, he would undoubtedly be called as a witness were this matter to end up in court. Mr. Elders felt, on balance, that his best course of action would be to avoid meeting you. A sensible man." Emma continued to look at the pile of notebooks. "Miss Barrington, it didn't take a lot of research to discover that you are the granddaughter of Lord Harvey and Sir Walter Barrington, which would account for your misplaced confidence when dealing with Americans. Allow me to suggest that if you intend to continue trying to pass yourself off as a literary agent, perhaps I can offer you some free advice, which is a matter of public record. Ernest Hemingway left America to live in Cuba in 1939. "How very generous of you, Mr. Jelks," interrupted Emma before he could continue. "Allow me to offer you some free advice in return. I know perfectly well that it was Harry Clifton," Jelks's eyes narrowed, "and not your client who wrote The Diary of a Convict. If you were foolish enough, Mr. Jelks, to issue a writ for slander against me, you might well find yourself in court having to explain why you defended a man on a charge of murder who you knew wasn't Lieutenant Tom Bradshaw." Jelks began frantically pressing a button underneath his desk. Emma rose from her chair, smiled sweetly at both of them, and left the room without another word. She marched quickly down the corridor toward the elevator, as Mr. Anscott and a security guard hurried past her on their way to Mr. Jelks's office. At least she'd avoided the humiliation of being escorted off the premises. When she stepped into the lift, the attendant inquired, "Which floor, miss?" "Ground, please." The attendant chuckled. "You must be English." "Why do you say that?" "In America, we call it the first floor." "Of course you do," said Emma, giving him a smile as she stepped out of the elevator. She walked across the lobby, pushed through the revolving doors, and ran down the steps and out onto the pavement, quite clear what she had to do next. There was only one person left she could turn to. After all, any sister of Lord Harvey had to be a formidable ally. Or would Great-Aunt Phyllis turn out to be a close friend of Sefton Jelks, in which case Emma would be taking the next boat back to England. She hailed a cab, but when she jumped in, she almost had to shout to make herself heard over the blare of the radio. 64th and Park, she said, working out how she might explain to her great-aunt why she hadn't visited her earlier. She leant forward and would have asked the driver to turn the volume down if she hadn't heard the words, "President Roosevelt will address the nation from the Oval Office at 12:30 this afternoon, Eastern Time."
Giles Barrington, 1941 to 1942. Chapter 20. The first thing Giles saw was his right leg hitched to a pulley and encased in plaster. He could dimly remember a long journey, during which the pain had become almost unbearable, and he had assumed he would die long before they got him to a hospital. And he would never forget the operation. But then how could he, when they'd run out of anaesthetic, moments before the doctor made the first incision? He turned his head very slowly to the left, and saw a window with three bars across it, then to the right. That's when he saw him.
"No, not you," Giles said. "For a moment I thought I'd escaped and gone to heaven."
"Not yet," said Bates. "First you have to do a spell in purgatory."
"For how long?"
"At least until your leg's mended. Possibly longer."
"Are we back in England?"
Giles asked hopefully.
"I wish," said Bates.
"No, we're in Germany. Weinsberg POW camp, which is where we all ended up after being taken prisoner."
Giles tried to sit up, but could only just raise his head off the pillow, enough to see a framed picture on the wall of Adolf Hitler